Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
I am very, very pleased to be introducing Temelio Butler. She is a business development associate at Harborview Equities Partners, and wrote a fascinating thesis that she's going to help us to understand, specifically focused on the Basquiat market and Black artists more broadly. You have a fascinating career. Tell us a little bit about your career trajectory, Tammy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited to talk about this because it's been so recent. I just graduated from Pratt in May of 2022, so just a few months ago. So it's really exciting to be able to share some of the research that I uncovered at such an early time. So my career has been pretty straightforward and early. I would say I graduated from Howard University in 2017. From Howard, I went straight to Goldman Sachs, where I spent 3.5 years on the trading floor and about a year in investment banking. And I can talk about either of those if anybody is interested, as you can imagine. Very interesting experience, especially being a Black woman. Last year in July, or August rather, I joined Harborview Equity Partners, which is a private equity startup focused on esoteric investments in the media and entertainment space. It was founded by a woman named Cherise Clark Suarez. It's been a fantastic experience. They work in business development there, so that's, you know, deal origination and then also fundraising. I decided to pursue an additional degree in arts and cultural management from Pratt Institute. It was kind of a passion project, I feel. A lot of people probably felt this way in 2020, so if I can paint the picture, it's like April of 2020, I just moved back in with my parents. What the heck is going on? I've just been in banking for almost 5 years, trying to find some more meaning and value out of my life. My mom is an artist, and I was really able to watch her develop and grow over the last few years. Right before the pandemic, she had this fantastic show in Harlem, and it was one of her first solo shows in New York City. And I wasn't able to visit because I was at a business conference, but I saw the footage from it, and I realized there was people lined up around the corner to see my mom's work, something that I had never experienced, although I had been with her through every facet of her career up until that point. I realized that, one, I needed something more creative in my life. My life had been very organized, cut and dry, black and white, and I was really looking for some more color, to not make a pun, but really was looking for something more creative and to think a little bit differently and a little bit more balance in my life. And I wanted to do something for me. As we know, like, these investment banking jobs are very, very taxing, emotionally and physically, and I wanted to do something for myself. So I was like, I'm going to apply to art school. Don't know if this is going to work. Let's see what happens. And fortunately, I was able to get in, and I actually completed that degree while I was working full-time the entire time, which is insane. I do not recommend anyone
That's
do
so
that.
Impressive, Sammy.
I don't recommend anyone do that, so please do what I say and not what I do.
Your mom's not just an artist. She's an amazing artist. Biza Butler is one of my favorite artists of all time. Tell the audience a little bit about how she works and her career trajectory.
Yeah, absolutely. So my mother is a fiber artist. She creates quilted portraits depicting the Black American experience. She was a fine arts major also at Howard University. We're a big Howard family. And then she got a master's as well in fine arts. And she started really doing her work full time after being an art teacher for most of her career. So my mom, for most of my life, was an art teacher who did artwork on the side. We obviously supported her as a family. We were all very passionate about what she was doing in building. We saw what she was doing every day and were blown away ourselves. But, you know, she really got the break and people really taking notice in around 2018. And there was this one anecdote she shares with us. She realized, as she was a school teacher, that she was able to make her teaching salary by selling like one quilt. And that's when you realize, like, this is like the breaking point in that, like, you've committed your entire life to developing younger kids and helping them realize their own intellectual and artistic capabilities. But now it's really time to bet on yourself.
So let's dig in a little bit to the research and what inspired your thesis, and explain a little bit about the genesis of that project.
You know, my mom, you know, had a full career before her formal art career. So why did it take this long? Why didn't she get this break earlier? How come that her artistic prowess wasn't noticed and recognized at an earlier time? And that really started the genesis of, let me understand, you know, what does it take for an artist to be successful? What is this world of the art market? Who provides value? Who are the gatekeepers? Who has the say? So that was really the crux of why I applied and was my entry essay into Pratt. I was able to write my thesis on how to effectively accelerate Black artists, figuring out ways to effectively accelerate Black artists. And when you think about this acceleration, the first question is, okay, so why do they need this help anyway? And that was a long and varied story as I kind of clawed my way through who determines success for artists. So our capstone project, which I worked with two additional colleagues, was to understand a framework that was triple bottom line by design, meaning people, profit, and planet, that helped accelerate Black artists, but also contribute to the creative economy. Because as we know, and I'm sure you know at Yield Street, you know, art is an asset, and it's something that should be capitalized and invested in. And we wanted to really make sure that we could figure out a way to do this while helping the artist as well. So that was really the background behind my research.
Fascinating. You took a special interest in the career of Jean-Michel Basquiat and his market, particularly since his death. Can you speak a bit to the disparities that you observed in the market among artists who people sort of think of as Black artists, although there are a lot of issues with that denomination to begin with?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the most salient research that I uncovered during my studies was a study done by Julia Halperin and Charlotte Burns. And this was a study that came out in 2019, and it really was a survey of Black artists in America using museum data and auction data. I think they surveyed upwards of 26 U.S. museums and over 400 auction houses. And they came up with some really incredible research about the state of Black art and the state of Black artists within the art market. They found that between the periods of 2008 and 2018, only 2.3% of museum acquisitions were of work by Black artists. And this is at a time when, you know, Black Americans are making upwards of 12% of the population. And while that was really notable, obviously, I think what was even more impactful to me was when they started really uncovering the auction data. They realized that of the $180 billion art market, Black art made up $2.2 billion of it, which is less than 2%. Of that $2.2 billion number, which is like, every time I say this, I'm like, how is this possible? 80% of it is attributed to Basquiat. That's $1.7 billion. Of the remaining, so if you think about the entire Black art market is $2.2 billion, Basquiat's was 1.7. Of the remaining, that $460 million, 300 of it is attributed to just five artists. So you see how the art market is extremely top-heavy, and it makes you ask these questions, why are things like this way? You know, obviously I'm doing this research in a period where the Black Lives Matter movement is really important, and, you know, with the murder of George Floyd, all industries and institutions are really thinking about our structures and the way that we are uplifting or damaging, you know, specific social areas, and that is something that was not lost upon the arts industry as well. What I learned, which is not a surprise, I'm sure, is that most of the people in the higher up positions are not diverse. And if they only have a limited amount of resources to uplift a minority, you know, group of people, they're going to pick the people that are going to have mass appeal.
Are you making distinctions here between and among curators and gallerists, or did you sort of think of them all?
I thought of them all lumped into one, because I would say curators, gallerists, art critics, all gatekeepers, they all have varying degrees of influence. I would say the most impactful is probably the curator or the branded art gallerist, because they have a lot of say into the things that really are at the forefront of public impression. And I would say, like, the general public is not all that up to date on the goings on of the art market. It's a very niche community as it is. So when the general public understands things about arts, they're only seeing the things that are in the front lines, in the headlines, the Kehinde Wileys, you know, the Julie Maritus, the Basquiats, of course. So if
Glenn Ligon.
Exactly. So if somebody is at a higher up position and has one bullet to get a Black artist in a museum, they're going to go for the superstars. It makes sense. There's this thing called superstar phenomenon in the art market. I think, because the nature of the arts is very subjective, you're going to go towards what you know and what you've heard of. And that leads to kind of this avalanche effect of people only selecting or providing value for the things that they have heard about before, leaving everyone else who is just as talented and provides just as much value really in the background, which leads to this extraordinarily top-heavy Black art market, which I thought was such an interesting point.
Your mom has recently switched representation. What do you think about the transition? Has been surprising? What do you think has really changed for her market specifically? She's now signed with Jeffrey Deitch, right?
Yeah.
That's very
so
exciting.
I think what was interesting about the transition was it was going on during a time when I was actually actively studying this. So I'm figuring out what are the catalysts for artists, what makes them successful. The gallery plays a huge role. There's, you know, the main street gallery, the ones that are looking for the middle market artists, and then there are your superstar blue chip, you know, galleries that really can take an artist to the next step. Obviously, there's consequences to both of those things, benefits and drawbacks. I think in my research, I was able to talk with, you know, over 50 to 100 artists about their career trajectory from all varying ages, older and younger. And something that I thought was really interesting, especially for the younger population, was this idea of like everything is DIY now. It's the same with musicians, right? Like you don't need a label, you don't need a gallery, just like sell your work on your own, use social media, use things like that. Because my mom was coming up at an age where she was already a seasoned artist, we really understood the intrinsic value of having gallery representation and the things that they can provide and unlock for you. I think being aligned to somebody like Jeffrey Deitch, who worked so closely with someone like Jean-Michel Basquiat, is so important, right? Just to be able to be lumped into the same conversations
for
with
sure.
someone who is so incredible, so impactful, years after the fact is so important.
You speak in the thesis a little bit about the investment thesis around art. Can you describe any findings or recommendations that you made in respect particularly of the sort of mid-career and as opposed to the blue chip artist, the mid-career artist?
Yeah, I think that if you are going into art investment, well, I guess it goes back to the question, why are you investing in art? Are you just trying to gain exposure to an uncorrelated asset, or are you specifically trying to make an outsized return? If you are going into this trying to make an outsized return, it's really challenging if you're only looking at Basquiat or Andy Warhol or Glenn Ligon because, you know, these prices are already high. I think where you really want to make the bet is the artists who are up and coming, you know, really accelerating someone who has a lot of promise but hasn't gotten there yet. I mean, those returns are absolutely astronomical if you think about it. And I can only think about my mom selling her first quilt for like $500 or something. I mean, gosh, like imagine if you got in at this level. And I think that really speaks to getting into this art world at the ground level, being able to interact with and connect with emerging artists, because if you're just looking for diversification, like by all means, go into the secondary market, you know, gain your exposure to a really high profile blue chip artist. But there's such a benefit from a return perspective to really advancing and putting forward a younger or middle tier artist. And
did you discover any surprises as you were doing the research? Anything that really wasn't consistent with what you had expected when you just went out?
I think the primary surprise for me was that, like, of course, I am here to uplift Black artists for multiple reasons. But when I tried to understand how does an artist gain success generally, I realized that the problem was for all artists. It wasn't specific to Black artists. I mean, obviously, we have a little bit more chips stacked against us, but there fundamentally is a bit of a problem in the art market. And I think it goes back to like even like the patronage model. And I feel like I sound ridiculous saying this, but if we go back to the Dark Ages, right, you had the patronage model where you had these grand patrons really financing the creation of art, art for art's sake, not focused on selling it, just art was being created because people were paying for it to exist. I think in today's day and age, art dealers have kind of subsumed this role with like an additional nuance in that they are also responsible for the work selling. And that really leads to the art market being a little bit unbalanced. And in my personal opinion, I feel the art market today was not made for artists. It's not virtuous. It's not unbiased. And it even goes back to the simplest things, like the archetype of the starving artist can be seen as like a rite of passage for success. Like, that can't be right. Like, how are we helping artists become artists and create art just because art is good? And I think that that was the most surprising thing, is the magnitude magnitude of this. And also, the art market has opportunities to help itself, and frequently it doesn't. And I think that it kind of leads in pretty closely and interestingly in the way that Basquiat's prices have been able to get so high, in that when he was growing up, you know, between the ages of 21 and 27, when he was really at the height of the art market, he really nestled himself very closely to the art market leaders, which is very important. And although a lot of his works was in direct contradiction of what the art market should be, I mean, he depicts, you know, banknotes and different letters of currency, often commenting on the monetary and capitalistic nature of the art market. But by aligning himself and making these sorts of commentary and even being aware that these things sort of exist, I think uplifted him and enabled him to be able to really be in this blue chip conversation and be the first black artist. I mean, blue chip black artist, rather. And I think you really see that his height was at the height of when the art market and the commercial market really became tied. And you saw that in his feature, the, what is it, New Art, New Money, where he's sitting on the cover wearing an Armani suit, but, you know, he's barefoot and the suit is paint splattered. So these two, you know, views are in direct opposition for each other. And I think that that conflict kind of gave people interest and made people excited and curious and really contributed to a lot of his success, which is really quite ingenious if you kind of step back and take a look.
When you toured the King Pleasure exhibit and had the opportunity to like really immerse yourself in his world, were there things that you discovered about him? I know you knew about him from your mother, but were there things that you discovered through that exhibition? Or
absolutely. I think I knew more than most. I mean, growing up with a mom who's not only an artist, but an art teacher, I definitely had a lot of art history and especially black art history teachings when I was growing up. But I think, you know, I've never been to an exhibition that was curated by a family member. And that is such an incredible experience to be able to see the art the way it was created in a way. I think the most interesting thing to me is that his work, in the King Pleasure exhibit, you have the opportunity to actually step into his studio and step into his family home. And stepping into his studio, I think the first thing I thought, and the first thing I thought in the exhibition was, there's so many noises happening around me. Like, there's a lot of talking, there's like music, there's like movies, there's like all these things happening at the same time. And when I first walked in, I was like, why would they design it this way? But then you get to learn that this is actually what the studio sounded like. Exactly. There was constantly people talking about, he constantly had the radio and the television and books sprawled all about, which kind of made me have a bit more clarity in terms of how his works could be packed with so much different information, which is something that I think that you wouldn't get by just walking into a white cube.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So
there was also a conversation that we were fortunate to have with Lizanne and Janine about the role that legacy plays and their responsibility and how they have chosen to sort of curate really an experience that hopefully reflects a more fulsome picture of who their brother was. And I think it was particularly interesting given, you know, that you're the daughter of an artist and must be thinking about these issues even now.
Yeah.
What was some of the more interesting things that they had to say about their choices?
Yeah, I mean, I think that their situation is extremely unique in that they have made Basquiat so accessible to the common person in a way that I believe has not been done in the past. I would say it's easier to get your hands on something of Basquiat than it is of something of Picasso at this point, which is so notable. I mean, like my phone case and my laptop case and my Doc Martin shoes all have Basquiat prints on it. And that is something that is so important to me and something that I think about all the time when you kind of consider the idea of democratizing access to high art, democratizing access to these
spaces. They were very criticized for having licensed some of the images so broadly, but I think they were really trying to achieve exactly what you point out, and in particular to make his art accessible to young black people.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a little bit of a shift, although his father very fiercely protected the body of work and all of the artifacts that they've saved. He had a slightly different perspective on it. And I think it's interesting that you have consumed so much of that.
Oh yeah, I'm a huge consumer. And I think it's really so important because I think like me, I'm a 26-year-old, you know, young professional, and my network of community is people who are like me. And one thing that people my age ask me all the time is like, how can I collect art? I don't really have an answer.
Well, we do.
You do.
Of course.
But I'm saying that's like a huge issue, yeah. right? Like, how do we provide access for people who don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to access this art? And it's really, really challenging. Even if you want to, like, if I am just interested in art and I want to go to like a Kehinde Wiley show, and then that means that I have to go to like this really high profile gallery, and like as a young Black person, like maybe I don't feel comfortable there, and does that mean that I don't get to see it? And I think that these are a lot of questions that people need to start thinking about. Like, if we are talking about bringing more people into the conversation, we're going to have to do it in different ways. And this also leads to like this whole different conversation of like, how can artists gain access to secondary royalties after the point of sale of their art that one time? Yes. An artist sells their work and it disappears forever. You never know where it goes. You never get any additional money. Like, how can we figure out a way to allow artists to buy into their life's work more? And I think that while they may have gotten a lot of criticism on that, I think people aren't thinking big enough in that, like, let's figure out how to provide longevity for something like a license. I mean, it's interesting now, and I think that I'm in a unique position given I invest in music right now, which is like investing in copyrights, and it's something that I constantly am thinking about for the visual arts, because I think about how lucky are these musical artists to be able to gain access to revenue generation for their songs for years and years to come and for the rest of their lives, and be able to sell their whole copyright and like live happy. Imagine if there was something like that for an artist.
Canada actually just joined the ranks of, I think, 192 countries that do provide resale royalties for artists.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened here yet.
Yeah. I think I don't know what needs to happen for us to get there in the art market. I do think that it does have something to do, and I feel like I hate to say this, I do think it has something to do with like blockchain and crypto and like that technology. Not exactly like digitizing every piece of artwork, but maybe just creating like a digital key to know that mm-hmm. this artwork exists and be able to tell when it changes hands. And I thought a lot about that during my research. It's such the wild, wild west right now that I definitely don't have like conclusive evidence that this is the way, but I do think that there are goalposts that mm-hmm. people are thinking about this more, which is good.
And one of the other ways I would think would be to support the gallerists who are really championing young or you know mid-career Black artists or women, and by doing so you really do bring up all of the artists in their roster. We have for a long time been sponsors at the Armory Show of the Presents Prize, which awards one booth the cost of their participation at the fair. So all of the newest gallerists compete for this prize, and one of the first prizes we awarded was to Marian Ibrahim.
Amazing.
Who everyone knows is now really one of the most important gallerists. And it's been wonderful to see how much impact that's had not only on her career trajectory, but on her ability to expose the artists that she represents.
Yeah, and I've seen that firsthand. I think as we were trying to find Black artists to interview for our research project, we're like, how do we find them? Like, where are they? Mm-hmm. And I definitely found that looking at her artist roster, I was able to have so many touch points on so many different Black artists, which is not super easy if you're dealing with one of these mega galleries. So I definitely commend her on really uplifting and bringing a lot of these Black artists to the forefront and making them more accessible to people like me.
Well, I want to posit that we do have sort of a solution for people who are looking for access. We have two different products that we offer. One is an art debt product and the other is an art equity product. So one is sort of income generating, the other is really, you know, a form of art ownership. And we are really hopeful that people will consider that through exposure to these offerings, they will establish enough of a base to really feel empowered to go out there and start to one day collect physical art themselves.
Yeah.
But you know about our funds, and we're very grateful that you took the time to come here to speak with us, and really wish you all the luck in the world with your career, and know that you're going to break things and do amazing things. So thanks so much for being with us, Temi.
Thanks
really
for having me.
It.
This is so exciting.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.